Did you memorize your Boy Scout?
On my honor, I will do my best.
You will, all right, then we'll let you sit down.
First degree is an offense that carries a heavier penalty. This is the one you want to hook them with.
Well, I would leave that to the committee. I would think that we could bring it in under a second degree offense.
Well, Mr. Pollock, can I ask a question? Let's read that on page 14. With the intent to obtain a benefit for that person or any person.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Certainly.
Or to injure or deprive another person or any person.
I believe it would not have any problem with that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Put in there that person or any person. Yeah, because another person, that takes care of that. That's,
or any person.
Yeah. Right. Is that okay, Jim?
That's right. That's fine. So the amendment would read on line 14, for that person or any person or to injure or deprive
right.
another person.
Yeah, you got it.
I would we put in line 14 after the word or any person and continue the balance of the sentence. I'm asking that said we approve the amendment objections here. That's the word. Continue, please.
Yes. So moving to the section 2.
Are you through a section? Excuse me, Mr. Pollock. You through a section 1, Mr. Senator?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
To move to section 2 and to explain for the benefit of Senator Ray, what we have here in section 2 is an amendment to an existing statute. And the idea was to differentiate between a situation when someone makes a false financial certification with the intent to benefit himself or another person now, or whether it's just a lesser type of a certification or an improper conduct. For example, when money is transferred between allocations within an appropriation, it requires a signature or approval from OMB and the head of the executive agency. What happens basically there is that money appropriation balances are not exceeded, but managerial control is lost by the executive branch into how money is moved between accounts, for example, for travel, personal services, contractual. And we feel it's very important, and I know that the Legislative Budget Audit Committee has agreed with us in the past, that we have this control. Yet when these certifications are made falsely and money is moved from one account to another, from one allocation to another, there really isn't any personal gain that's derived here. A particular agency receives a certain benefit, that's for certain, but there's no exceeding of the account balances. We wanted to be able to reach that kind of activity with this criminal statute at a level which would be cost-effective for us to prosecute at. In other words, for this kind of activity, we don't want to go in and prosecute someone for a felony offense. But if they were doing it to enrich themselves, we certainly would want to do that. So our purpose here is to divide the two types of conduct into separate degrees of the offense. And then we added a new element to the existing tampering criminal statute, which has now become the second degree of the crime, and that's the false certification. And a question was asked by the committee last time, and we'll address that now, as to why, as you see as we go down through elements 1 and 2 of the tampering offense, the second degree part of it, you'll see that each of those acts take the requisite mental states with knowledge, that they do it knowingly. In other words, they have to be fairly certain that what they were doing was false or incorrect conduct. Yet when you get down to element number 3, the mental state required there is with reckless disregard of the fact that the claim is not lawful. So what we're doing is making this a little bit higher standard of care that a certifying officer has to exercise when they carry out their duties. The reckless disregard standard means that they are aware of a risk, but disregard that risk when they undertake their action. Again, this is a situation we feel must be we'd like to see enacted in the law. This language we'd like to see enacted because it gives us a stronger hand to dealing with certifying officers who may play fast and loose with the intent of the legislature or the administrative controls that we impose on our people.
Let me ask a question.
Sure.
You go back to what you said in the video regarding allocations and appropriations. You can't make... What's better?
No, not you. I'll cover myself.
Okay. He doesn't sound about himself. He gets the answers to you. Allocations. When there's allocations made, those allocations cannot be changed, can they?
Oh, yes, sir, they can.
Okay, then it is the appropriation within the allocation that can't be changed.
Well, allocations are within appropriations, first off. And we have the authority by the statute, AS 3707080E, to make changes between allocations within appropriations if certain approvals are obtained by the proper officials.
Now, therein lies some of the problem. If they make those changes, that's a certification. Is that what we're doing here?
Well,
when they sign that, it's certification that they knew what they were doing. Is that true?
Well, not exactly. When you go to write a check to someone from the state to a vendor, for example, before you can get a warrant drawn from the Treasury, a certifying officer has to certify that this is a true and correct claim against the state Treasury. It's within the purpose of appropriation enacted by the legislature, and there's a sufficient unobligated balance in that appropriation to pay the claim. So the certification we're talking about here is where the certifying officer makes that certification, says, yes, it's a good claim, yes, pay it from the state Treasury. Now, there is also a certification that goes on the documents that make the journal or voucher changes on our state records to move money from one account to another or from one allocation to another. That's also a kind of a certification we're talking about here. So we're talking about a range of certifications that a certifying officer makes every day in their normal duties.
And what is that statute? That does not allow you to move allocations from one allocation to another, or it's appropriation from one to another.
Right. Well,
one. Is that?
I believe it's AS 3707080E, I believe, states that you cannot move money from one appropriation to another unless it's enacted by law, unless it's the transfer is approved by law. However, allocations within appropriations can be made subject to certain approvals.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Quite a minute there. Why do we get such muddy language with reckless disregard of the fact that they claim upon law? Is that thing that's inscribed in the granite, it's a state of the art or something? It's so muddy and mucky that nobody knows what the hell you're talking about.
Wouldn't you have to prove what reckless was, and then again, disregard, and then again, reckless disregard? Wouldn't that cause a terrible lot of problems?
Well, in our minds, Mr. Chairman, it would not. This language, with reckless disregard, is a term of art that's used throughout Title 11, the Alaska Criminal Code. So we felt that this language, it's essential to use this language in order to be consistent with the usage in other sections of the Criminal Code. In other words, it has an established meaning in the Alaska Criminal Code, and it has an established meaning in the minds of the courts. So to use a different term, even though it might be better, it may not be so muddy, and I agree with you, a lot of the language we use in our criminal statutes is not the paragon of clarity that it should be. Yet, once it's there and once it's in place and in use, it's somewhat dangerous to change.
No, I disagree with that, Jim. Come on now. Just because you guys are attorneys doesn't mean you're supposed to write some foreign language. If you're supposed to write these statutes so that the ordinary man on the street can at least have an intelligent appraisal of what's being written so he doesn't have to hire an attorney to tell him what it says. Now, what if you say reckless disregard of the fact that the claim is not lawful? What are you saying in effect?
That they're aware of the risk, that there is a risk that their action is...
That isn't what reckless disregard of the fact that the claim is not lawful. That's somebody's supposition. That isn't what it says. A reckless disregard of the fact that the claim is not lawful is he knows that it isn't lawful, and he has a reckless disregard. So he just goes ahead and does it, and he knows it isn't lawful.
Well, I don't think we want
that isn't what you tried to say.
Well, we don't want to say that, Senator. We don't want to say that he has actual knowledge that what he's doing is false.
And why don't you say it that way? Then what you're saying here is that he has an actual reckless disregard of the fact that he knows it is not lawful.
Well, if you require knowledge, then I think what we'll be doing is actual knowledge that what he's doing is not lawful. Then we'll be in a situation that we can never possibly.
I'm not arguing that fact, Jim. What I'm arguing is the fact that what you're saying is what you don't want to say. What you're saying is what you're just saying that you don't want to say, and you're actually saying that.
Well, with all due respect, Senator, I don't see it that way, and I'd be happy to sit down with you, with our experts in criminal law, which I must profess not to be. I'm a civil lawyer myself, and I'd like to sit down with you with perhaps someone from our criminal division and go over this with you in great detail so that we can get this bill moving as it's a very important bill.
Jim, I
understand. We're not trying to hold the bill.
Certainly.
We want to get some intelligence into the bill. Now, let me point out
my looking at, as I look at it, not in the eyes of an attorney. If I certify a public record setting out a claim against the government agency or the property of the government agency, and I do this with reckless disregard of the fact that the claim is not lawful, I know that I say this is not, I know this is against the law.
Right.
I know that is. Whether it be reckless disregard of knowing it or not is another story. But if I say with of a government agency, knowing that the claim is not lawful, or that payment of the claim is not authorized in the budget of the government agency, in other words, that's pinning it down right down to the deal. Look, if I certify that and I know that that thing is unlawful, I'm in trouble. Yeah. Isn't that true? Isn't that, could anybody, in fact, the guy that's down there in the agency, and somebody says, hey, did you see this statute you just violated? What do you mean?
No.
He says, yeah.
No. But that is what he's trying to get at, Mr. Chairman. What he's trying to get at is a certifying officer looks at it and says, I don't know whether it's legal or not, but I'll take a chance.
Precisely.
All right. Precisely. That is what you're saying. You're saying here, with a reckless disregard, he knows that the claim is not lawful. In other words, what you want to say is a careless, a reckless disregard, not knowing whether it's lawful or not. That's what I'm trying to say.
I think we're trying to say the same thing.
But you aren't doing it. You're pinning it down that he has a reckless disregard of the fact that the claim is not lawful. In other words, he knows it is not lawful. And he's recklessly disregarding the fact that he knows it's not lawful. In other words, there's no question in his mind that it's legal. He knows it's unlawful.
It could be just a simple word change. Then
something like that, yeah.
With the reckless disregard of whether the claim is lawful.
Yeah, something like that. And then you got it, because that's what you're trying to do.
It covers the guy that knows it's illegal, and it also covers the guy that doesn't really know, but he goes ahead and does it anyway.
Well,
see, what I think you got here, Jim, is a certification that the guy that signed it knows that it's not lawful, and he goes ahead and reckless disregard does it. But you want to put down there a guy that doesn't take the time to go look it up.
Right.
He just goes and says, well, I'll take a whack at this, let her go.
Right, you have to hit the nail on the head, Senator. That's what we want to reach. With that guidance in mind, if we could take this back to our criminal experts and make sure that they
don't
have a
problem. Anything with it right this minute?
Well, I have done it. I've said with reckless disregard of whether the claim is
lawful. We don't want him to make reckless disregard of the fact that we don't know what he's doing.
Bless himself, there's a lot of effect.
I'm flying by the seat of my pants here, and I'm hoping that I'm not causing problems on the criminal side of our department.
We'd just like to bring up the fact that we're not holding the bill up. You are.
Yeah. Well, reckless disregard of whether the claim is lawful. How about that language? I think that it removes the...
That's right.
It's not lawful or lawful.
Of whether it is lawful.
Of whether the claim
is
lawful.
That's better, Jim.
So we'll read reckless disregard of whether the claim is take out not is lawful,
right,
or that payment of the claim is not authorized in the budget.
Right.
There
you go.
Okay, let's just make that change in the wording of there. Are there any objections to making that change?
No, so moved.
Okay.
Now, when you get down there to the next part of here.
Maker.
Yes, as we move down to
Maker.
Before the committee met this morning, Senator Ray asked me under B3, and I believe it begins at line 11, whether makes the false entry, and then further down on line 15, the word whether we attend the word maker. I believe we do.
Yeah, but don't you want to say that the maker knows to be untrue? Not that he believes it to be untrue, but he knows it's untrue. Otherwise, you have another reckless disregard up here.
Right. Well, the term is used on page 1, line 12, knowingly makes a false entry. So if you, the word knowingly is applied to that phrase. So as
it's
used,
line 12, I'm sorry.
Yes, well, what I'm saying is, this is a definition appearing on page 2, makes a false entry, where we have the question.
Yeah. Well, how does it refer back to line 12?
Well, that term is used on line 12, knowingly makes a false entry.
I don't see that. What
22,
are you reading
from?
Hey, I'm sorry, my 22. The numbers are obliterated on the side,
okay.
So it is line 22.
Right,
thank you, Senator.
Right.
So the phrase that is defined on page 2 is makes a false entry, and then the term knowingly is applied to that, Senator. So I think that meets your concern about knowledge.
I don't mean it either. The guy first commits a crime of tampering with public records in the second degree if the person knowingly means to change or create a public record, whether complete or incomplete, by means of erasure, obliteration, deletion, insertion, in matter, transmission, or abandonment, so that the record so changed or created states or implies the fact that the maker does not believe to be true. If he knowingly knows it, there's no if, ands, or buts about it. If he knows it, which you're saying he does, then he knows it to be untrue. It isn't that he believes it to be untrue, he knows it to be untrue. In fact, that's what you're saying. He knowingly knows it's untrue. He knows it's wrong.
That's right.
But you're saying he believes it to be wrong. By the fact that the maker does not believe to be true. Hey, he just knows it isn't true if he knowingly knows it. Knowingly knows it.
Okay, now, and,
you know what I'm getting at, Jim?
Jim, I'm getting a distinct impression that
you're not
comfortable in doing
Jim,
it.
Jim, we should put this on, Jim.
A little bit more counsel on it, or a little bit more thought to it. I wondered if it would be possible for you to go over these problems that we do have and come back with this, the changes in this, as soon as you possibly can so I can get it out of here.
Yes, certainly.
If you do that, I think you'd feel more comfortable that way.
When would you next meet, Mr. Chairman?
I'll pull it up. We can, excuse me a moment, we can do this on Tuesday very quickly without any trouble by Tuesday.
Great. I appreciate your giving me this time to spread it out, and I appreciate your guidance on this.
That's not fair for you.
Thank you very much.
In view of the circumstances, we'll hold the bill until Tuesday, and Mr. Baldwin, you will get that down just prior to Tuesday.
Right. One other issue I'd like to raise, if I could get a change in this committee on this particular bill, and I just noticed that as I sat here, the title of the bill says, an act relating to public records and certification of state vouchers. With the permission of the committee, I'd like to remove the word state and insert the word government, since the scope of the bill is much broader than state vouchers. It covers government vouchers. And I think the title may well be a little
I think what you need is a document of a paper or something, because this is not a legislator's, it's a governor by rules, and I think what you have to do is you have to get the approval of the maker so that it's done by law.
Mr. Baldwin, make the changes you feel necessary.
And we'll explain to
what the committee wants and what is best for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry, I am. Oh, Mr. Bischoff, yes. You didn't want to do anything.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's all been said.
Fine. I just wanted you to have the opportunity. Thank you. The next bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 1. I know Senator Josephson here. I think I'll take up his bill next. SGR 15, is that correct?
Right.
Senator Josephson. Senate Bill proposing amendment to the Constitution next week of the last week. You got me going. Creating a commission on compensation of elected officials. Senator Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the scheduling of these measures, Senate Bill 161, which is companion to SJR 15 and SJR 15.
Excuse me, one moment. I'll be taking that up simultaneously.
I believe now there are five sponsors to these measures since their introduction in the Senate. And I can give the committee something of the reasons and the history. Since I became a legislator in 1963, the issue of legislative pay has been politically sensitive and extremely difficult. When I began my legislative service, the legislative pay was $3,500. And as a freshman member of the House, I authored a bill to raise it to $5,000 and got some negative editorials in the Anchorage Times for that. Since then, observing this process, I think that the legislature has always been in a no-win situation, no matter what it does. Because legislators, when we deal with the issue of legislative pay, are in the difficult position of trying to set a value on our own services. In a recent article regarding the Congress, which has the same problems, national columnist Jody Powell commented, and this was in the Anchorage Times on Monday, March 4th, that James Madison tried to have the Constitutional Convention recognize that having the Congress determine its own compensation was an indecent thing. He suggested amendments to avoid the problem. And Mr. Powell goes on to say that what has happened since is that the Congress has never been able to address the issue of legislative pay We now have members of Congress who maintain homes in their districts and sleep in their offices to save money. We have legislators who are candidates and congresspersons who cannot run anymore for office. And politically, the Congress cannot deal with the issue. And you know, Mr. Chairman, and certainly and others know, that in our political campaigns, it is a kind of Gresham's law of politics that this issue drives out other issues. Instead of talking about the real public policy questions that are important to talk about, a lot of the focus is on the issue of legislative pay, and I think it diminishes the level of public debate at election time about the real choices between that face Alaskans. Now, when I helped draft the municipal charter in Anchorage in 1975 as vice chair of the Charter Commission and co-chair of the drafting committee, I proposed at that time that the matter of assembly and mayor's pay be handled by a commission on salaries and emoluments. And that is part of the Anchorage Municipal Charter for the last 10 years now. And there has never been public outcry in Anchorage. There's public confidence that those salaries of the mayor and assembly are fairly set. We have the minutes of those meetings since 1975, and I think my aide may have circulated the most recent meetings. It just is a non-issue. Sometimes assembly members go before the commission and argue that the salaries ought to be reduced or to the contrary, but there is never any doubt that the assembly doesn't fix its own pay and the public accepts whatever the compensation is, and it's an automatic thing. And that's the concept here. In my opinion, it will lead to greater respect for the legislature, greater confidence in the legislative branch, remove from our agenda an issue that we cannot handle comfortably with apparent fairness or equity and with public confidence. Now, in 1986, there at the present time, there is scheduled to be an initiative to repeal the 1983 pay increase. We may adopt legislation in this legislature that makes that move, and SJR 15 and SB 16 wouldn't avoid the possibility. I mean, the legislature still would have the right to act on those proposals to change the pay bill. This is neutral as far as that is concerned. But if the legislature does not take action which removes the initiative from the ballot, I think one of the helpful things about this is that it will reduce the temperature level on that initiative question, because there will also be the ballot question of whether the Constitution should be amended to create the Commission on Compensation of Elected Officials. Now, I will not be a candidate in 1986, but those who are running for office can say to the electorate that whatever happens on the initiative, if they want to say this, they favor the adoption of the new amendment to create a commission on compensation, remove the issue from the legislature. I suppose the outcome on the initiative vote could be taken into consideration by the commission. The public, in any case, will be involved because public hearings are required, as they are in Anchorage. And so I just think it's time we reform our process. If we don't do it, we're going to be in this business of reviewing our legislative pay every year or two. There will be those who demagogically will attack those legislators who do support legislative pay changes, increments. And there will be legislators, I suppose, who will be greedy and ask for too much. I mean, those are always the possibilities. And I don't know what too much is, personally. That's a value judgment. But I really think that we'll have a better system with better addressing of the real issues if we take this particular matter out of the legislature's own agenda. And that's the purpose of the proposal.
Senator Josephson, did I understand you to say a moment ago that you would not be a candidate in 1986?
Right. Yes.
Is that for anything?
Oh. As far as I know, that's correct. You have to ask.
I think you've got it on television now. I wanted to be sure you clarified that statement.
He's not a candidate for the Supreme Court, are you?
Well, Jerry Ward tried that and it didn't fly.
Oh, I see. I don't like the Attorney General.
I think that'll probably come out on mobile television is being a blooper. I'm not really sure, but I'll leave it up to the press.
Won't be the first time.
I see.
The issue of the one thing I might mention is the way these are drafted. The issue of retirement is not in the purview of the Commission on Compensation. The committee may want to consider that, but the reason for that is because it's contemplated that retirement would be a matter of general law applying to all officers of the state, and it involves some fairly technical questions, actuarial questions, and the like. But all other emoluments of the legislature, per diem and travel expenses, allowances, are going, would be within the purview of the commission.
Senator, you've had some conversation and some thought that, and some of us are, including myself, are very reluctant to have an amendment to the Constitution of Alaska and opening that up.
Why? I don't understand.
Would this take a constitutional convention to do this?
No. This, you know, whenever someone proposes an amendment, he or she is likely to say, all we're trying to do is give the people a chance to vote, and that I could make that argument here, that all that SJR 15 is it allows the people to decide whether the people want to have legislative pay decided by a commission instead of by legislators. It does not require a constitutional convention. It's the standard amendment process that we've used time and again since statehood.
All right, I'm sorry, I just confused it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
Does it make any sense, Senator Joson, in the resolution here, that if we're going to do this, and we're going to put them up, then you still have the people getting in the act, and they can knock it out by initiative or referendum. And yes. So you're going to go right back to the same thing you have now.
Well, I think not, because I think that the credibility of the decision-making process will have much more acceptance. There won't be, for example, there won't be any motive from any politician to attack the commission's decision, because there's no incumbent who could be derogated by that effort. There won't be the appearance or the reality of self-serving, because the people in the commission have nothing to gain from the decision.
Well, so, again, I humbly disagree with him, because as long as there's going to be an individual running for office, and if he is comfortable in his money matters, he's going to, if he feels that we'll give him a step up, he's going to attack the salary schedule, no matter if he would attack the one that's there now. Some people feel that we can serve for nothing. At least that's the public impression that he'd like to give. And we already had a board like this one time before, and they set up a salary and they kicked it out.
No,
they didn't want that at all.
No, the board, you know, that I've heard that, and as I understand it, the board that you had before was not this kind of a body, because under this amendment, the legislature shall fund their decisions.
That in the argument. That in the
argument. No, but I mean that board was advisory, and it still came back into the legislature's bailiwick. It didn't really do anything. In the 10 years, as I said, in Anchorage, we've never had anybody rag around the decisions of the Emoluments Commission for political purposes. And it has not been an issue. Now, it could happen, I suppose, if someone would say the commission went off the deep end in one direction or another, and we ought to have the initiative process. I'm not offended by that if someone wants to do that. But I really think, in practical terms, this is going to depoliticize the question and raise public confidence, let the legislature get on with its business. I, as one legislator, quite frankly, you know, I'm honored to serve here, as we all are, and I'll be happy to serve under whatever, at least until 1988, under whatever pay decisions are made by the commission. It's not going to offend me if they say it's too high.
Senator, let me ask a question. When you were on the municipal charter, did this thing ever come up, the same issue come up for a vote on the municipal elections?
Well, the charter provision was, I don't know what you mean, was there was no separate vote of the people on the salaries commission. It was embraced within the constitution of Anchorage, or the charter of Anchorage, and that was ratified by the people by vote.
Senator Ray.
But you're still begging off the original question. Irrespective of whether you call this an advisory committee or whether it's a constitutional committee, you still are allowing the opening for the people by initiative or referendum, which I know is probably politically astute, but I mean, it's going to create the same problems that you have now, I believe. I mean, with due respect, that you and I served together during that time that you tried to raise the salaries, and I was very much behind you at that time. Unfortunately, I'm not too far behind you. But I understand what you're trying to do, and I appreciate it, and I sympathize it, and I support it to a certain degree, if I thought that it was going to be the end of it. But it isn't going to be the end of it. It's a valiant effort, and I commend you for that. And I just don't believe it will be the end.
One other question. You said this commission takes took care in the municipality of the mayor and the what?
And the assembly. And the school board.
And the assembly. And how about all the rest of the salaried employees?
Just elected officials.
Just elected officials. Well.
No, I don't think that. I think the legislature.
In your paragraph, Doug, if I may finish, line 24, a law applying to all salaried officers of the state.
Right.
On page 1, line 24, 22, 23, 24, in context, does that mean that this commission, the municipality doesn't set the salaried employees of the city, they just set certain people that. Did you mean this to go for all salaried employees in the state? Is that the same category as the municipality?
What we're talking about there is this, that in the present Alaska Constitution, there is a provision that says that the compensation of the governor and lieutenant governor shall not be diminished during their term of office. Because the people who wrote the Constitution did not want the legislature, in a dispute with the governor and lieutenant governor, to say, well, we're going to cut your salary 10% unless you do X, Y, or Z. And that's just in the separation of powers and of checks and balances. They didn't want that wrapped around the governor and lieutenant governor as a threat.
But why should the legislators want it?
Excuse me, pardon me?
Why should legislators want it?
Want to have their salary reduced? Well, this paragraph relates only to executive compensation. And what it means is that if there was say a budget crisis, imagine such a thing, and a decision that we had to cut all state employees by 5%, then the commission, in that context, could say we're going to cut the governor and lieutenant governor 5% also. That's the kind of thing this envisions. Otherwise, the present doctrine that the governor and lieutenant governor will not have their salaries diminished during their term of office will remain in effect, will be respected.
I think that would be a good idea that you suggested there, that 5% cut right on down the line.
Did you want to start that out to your salary?
No, I...
Oh, I thought you meant with your salary.
Whose ox are you talking about?
No, I was thought you were going to gore your own ox there for a minute. If I might ask another...
Go ahead, Senator.
Senator, being a very intelligent person and a lawyer, some recruit in the state, and we keep talking about the Constitution, and you'll hear so many people talk about the Constitution of the state and saying that, by golly, don't touch that. That's a wonderful document, etc. I think I'm of the opinion, as well as you are, that the Constitution after 25 years is a little frayed around the edges. There's several things in there that were put in there, particularly to stop any kind of interaction with those people who are setting up the Constitution itself, and they're moving into state government. And the reason I'm saying this is that there are three or four articles in the Constitution that are no longer valid. And one of them, of course, is those people who are in office having to sit out for 1 year because they voted on a pay raise for anybody. Well, now that is absolutely asinine and silly. And yet, by the time that you put it out to the populace and for them to get some kind of a feeling for it, there's so much anti-touching the Constitution and it's so convoluted by the Attorney General's office and how they write it up and it comes backwards a lot of times.
Well, I think that's true. I think the example you cite is a correct example, too. I mean, in practical terms of it is that no governor could appoint any sitting legislator to any cabinet position because we all vote on pretty much annually or biannually on pay adjustments because of cost of living changes. This SJR 15 is another reflection of that. I don't think that the people who wrote the Constitution understood or could contemplate either the workload of the legislature, how it would change, differ from territorial days, how inflation would affect the post-statehood era, and how political the issue of legislative pay was going to become. And I think in the light of our experience looking back 20 years, it's time to say, hey, you know, this is a no-win situation. We're just beating ourselves over the head. I have a tremendous reverence for the legislative branch. I mean, no matter what party is in control of the legislature, what party is in control of the executive, people who know me know that I think the legislature is the people's branch. We're closer to the people than the executive. And I respect the legislature. And I just don't want to see the legislative branch subjected all its life into the far distant future with the negatives of this issue that it can't possibly come out on. And that's where we are today.
Senator, I think you just hit the nail on the head when you made the statement that this would not be in front of us had the inflation and the cost of living been discussed and understood by the public when this, all this pay raise business came up. That's the one. There was the two things that are not taking into consideration. Had they done that, we wouldn't have this like they do with state workers and so on, and raises and so on, cost of living, inflation, etc. We wouldn't have any of these bills in front of us today. So you hit the nail on the head. When you
Mr. Mr. Chairman, I think we have another problem, which is people. Again, this is neutral as to what the legislative pay ought to be. I want to stress that. But I think, personally, we have another problem when people and editorial writers compare the Alaska legislature to other state legislatures. You can't do that because, for example, Mr. Ashley Reed just came back from Maryland, Annapolis, Maryland. Every legislator lives within 2 hours of the Capitol. They don't meet on Mondays to allow the members to do their business and professions on Mondays as well as weekends. They have established counties and cities everywhere in Maryland. They have a 200-year history of settled law. You can't make comparisons to a state like Alaska, but that's a side issue.
Senator, being reflective, I don't know, but I think that we could settle a lot of the problems of the state as far as legislative ethics and violation of those types of things if we would just take and pay a legislator anywhere from $50,000 to $60,000 annually, and exclude him from doing anything else but being a legislator. In other words, his private business he isn't in any private business, so he has no connections whatsoever, and he's going to be a legislator, and that's his job, and that's all he can do is legislate. And there's plenty of work for a guy if he wants to do it. And that's the way to do it.
If you're a wealthy man, you don't have to worry about a low pay. You still have a job.
What I'm getting at is that if you pay a legislator enough money so that he can survive without the shades of the North Slope Borough or some of the other things that are coming around, it makes you. They keep talking about ethics and how they want, and you hear a leading newspaper, which will remain nameless because I don't like to sully my tongue with it. Always crying the blues about it. We need citizen legislators, and we need guys to go down there and work for 15 days and go home. Well, that's fine, but nobody in the state would be served. And they don't care because they're going to sell the newspapers anyway. But I mean, I think that the public perception of the legislature is so outmoded and is so wrong that there's a... Edna, you just got into it now. Did you?
It takes four times a day. The minute I was elected, people thought I was in and could do, and I
it
didn't even
crazy,
start, and
that.
I was trying to wrap up personal business and didn't have a staff or anything. And, they expected you to go to work the minute after you won, and, you didn't have anything to go along with it.
I think the other...
2 months.
Oh, excuse me, Senator. I think the other part about this is that we are a co-equal branch of government.
Right.
And to be a co-equal branch of government, we have to try to know as much about a lot of things as the executive branch people do. And, just for example, the other day I was in the Finance Committee listening to a hearing about the Anchorage office building, about net profits leasing, about all kinds of very subtle business decisions about whether that building should be built, and how you appraise it, and how you do the RFPs and all that. If we don't have the time, take the time to understand those things, we can't be a co-equal branch and really exert checks on the executive.
But all the information, if I might, Mr. Chairman, all the information that was provided to you at that time was provided by the administration. It was not an independent offering, or it was not your own. It was by somebody else, and you have... That's what the whole budget process is, and how we've finally gotten away from a lot of that, and then we have full-time budget
finance. A person with experience in public administration and a representative of labor. These are a cross-section group. If they come out and say, this is what we think the legislature should be doing, these are the responsibilities, these are the financial issues involved, and these are our decisions, I think they can explain and educate the public much better than we can, because we're perceived to be feathering our nest or self-serving when we do it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unless there are other questions?
I have some questions about
directly
to the delegate, just say, Glancy Manning. Let me see now which one. Okay. On the Senate Joint Resolution on page 2, the commission would be set up of 5 members, and I know that you say where 4 of those members would, you know, be attained. Was there a reason you left off the 5th member, that there would not have, or should there be a statement in there saying that that 5th member should be at large, or what? What was your feeling regarding that?
Well, these are. It says that there will be at least 1 business executive, mm-hmm. and so forth. There could be 2 business executives, right. for example. I left that to the discretion of the appointing authority and the confirming authority.
That's okay.
Okay, and also, what about, you were silent on whether they could be reappointed after the 6 years, I think, from what I read. Is that right? You did not make a statement regarding that?
I didn't prohibit their, I don't mean to prohibit their reappointment.
Okay, that's what I didn't say that in there either. That was two concerns I had.
Tell me, I note in here that the compensation for this commission, what is the fiscal note on this? Do you have any idea, or you didn't obtain one, or what?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have a fiscal note given to me.
Perhaps we could that.
I think we could work with your staff to get that for you.
Okay. What is your committee?
I'd
like to see the fiscal note. Okay, we will obtain the fiscal note. This is the first time you've heard the bills. We will take them both up again. Well, let's see. Yes.
And just glancing at the minutes from Anchorage, they have a discussion here regarding, and you have the same wordage in your bill, regarding how often they could meet. And one of the things they said in here was that they felt, let me see if I can find it now, that they felt that it needed, that the commission really should meet periodically throughout the year rather than more than once a year, that they shouldn't be compelled to meet. They should be allowed to meet more than once a year. And I was wondering if you had addressed that or thought that through regarding your bill, because they surely would have an equal responsibility. And so I was wondering what the feeling was there.
Yeah, I had no strong feelings about it and wasn't aware of that those minutes when I drafted this. However, there may be some value, on the other hand, in not having them meet frequently, because I don't want to be in a situation where some politician calls them up and says, hey, why don't you meet? I'm a little short this month, or something like that. I just want to have a stable situation, assure that they do come up at reasonable intervals, but that it isn't something you can switch on and off.
Senator, if it did go into effect, then, and we do establish it, and the commission became very active and they made the decisions, boom. No reason why that shouldn't stand for some time to come.
That's true.
And why should they meet again, just to, for the sake of the meeting, to discuss, is it all right? They'll know well enough whether it's all right or not, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't know. The minute, as you know, minutes sometimes don't really tell you what, you know, why they thought that. And I think there's no question about the fact that they shouldn't be adjusting salaries every 6 months, but apparently this committee felt that they would have reason to meet more often than that, and that maybe we should get some further background on why they felt that.
It should be also... and I like that portion of it, where they can't meet more than once to discuss things because somebody says, hey, I want you to take another look at it.
Yeah.
I think that should be...
But they couldn't change it more than every 2 years.
Or every
something.
4.
Yeah, something. Mm-hmm.
2 matters for your record. In House District 15, Representative Phillips did a poll this year. He sent out 4,595 questionnaires and 812 responses. In that sample, 74.3% favored the establishment of the Salaries Commission by the state, similar to the commission used by the municipality to oversee and propose changes in legislators' pay. 25% said no. So there was a strong public response. And on February 20, 1985, the Anchorage Daily News in an editorial supported these measures.
Of course, that's all sectional.
That's right.
Regional.
Okay, we will hold these bills until we get the information.
I think they had 80% to move the capital to.
Is that, would that be the conclusion of your testimony?
See what wisdom there is there.
Is there anyone else? Yeah, some order, please. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Want to get out from the way of the camera? Senator, thank you. You guys print that. Is there anything further to come before the committee? Incidentally, I would like to say before we leave, the cameraman looked just beautiful this morning. Thank you very much. There's nothing to come before the committee. We're adjourned.